all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Hey, good morning, good morning, good morning. How are we doing on that volume, man? Are we peaking on that thing? Yeah, okay. Somebody said that. Hey, Bob, you really come on strong. Well, you know what? You get geared up on Sunday. Starts early in the morning. You got a program to do, and we're doing it all live. We've been doing about 600 of these, and by the way, we're coming up with our anniversary program November 9th. You're going to want to mark that calendar. What do you want to mark the calendar, Bob? Well, it's our anniversary. It'll be our 11th time. I mean, 11 years on the air. Dale, Jim, Bob, Gary, wow, Nina, Derek, all the gang, yeah. And by the way, Derek, hello.
Hi.
Hi. And Nina? Yeah, she's waving. Okay, she waves with a smile. There you go. This is Veterans Radio. Bob Gould, another edition of Veterans Radio. So we got to get caught up on some of the current event stuff, all the stuff that you want to hear. New Jersey. New Jersey. Who in the heck lives in New Jersey? Homdel, New Jersey. I know. I'm just kidding. Just kidding. Homdel, New Jersey on Thursday, October 30th, the New Jersey Vietnam Veterans Memorial Foundation will hold its annual gala, A Night at the Museum, 2014 Salute to Patriotism. That's at the Vietnam Era Museum. The foundation is honoring those New Jersey businesses and individuals who come together to design and construct the Huey Plaza. On this plaza sits a two-tour Vietnam Huey helicopter. My friend Dale and partner and co-host would love that. Yeah, he was a chopper pilot. He was one of those Huey guys. The icon of the Vietnam War, that Huey helicopter. Synonymous, right? Lady in, what was that? Miss Saigon. There you go. Everything all about that. And that the dedication was May 7th, but the New Jersey Vietnam Veterans Remembrance Day. Okay, and they just completed that. So you're going to want to go and check on the New Jersey Vietnam Veterans Memorial. By the way, folks, if you do have an announcement you'd like us to make over Veterans Radio, please, please email us, bob@veteransradio.net or dale@veteransradio.net. And yeah, we'll put that on the air. Something else coming up. Oh, yeah. All you Marines, former Marines, I once made the mistake and said ex-Marine. Well, you're an ex-Marine. Woo, that was a Marine major. Yeah. I still got the teeth marks on that one. Whew. Anyway, so you're always a Marine. And the anniversary birthday ball is coming up. This one happens to be in Washtenaw County, and it will be held on. The tickets are $10. That's good. And I'm looking here. The birthday ball, this year's epic event will include live entertainment, gourmet dinner, ooh, that's always nice, cash bar, and a complete USMC birthday ball regala, including cake cutting. Apparently the cake is very symbolic. What happened there? Did we lose something? We're back, right? We're back. Yeah, he's shaking his head. Okay, the mice ran across the control panel. There we are. But It's going to be all this cake thing, this cake. Maybe next week we'll get a chance to talk about this. It's all part of the regala. It's all part of the whole Marine anniversary thing. They're all about cake and passing of the cake and cutting of the cake. So that will be on November 10th, and that will be the Marines. Let's see, they were started in 1775, so 225. What is that, Derek? Come on, you went to college. 239 years, is that? Did I get that right? Something like that. Yes, it's going to be a big anniversary, folks. I'm not making light of it. No emails, not at all. In fact, we got two Marines on the program today. Yes, from the Korean War. Can you believe that? Yeah, those guys are still around, and they're they're fun and they're lucid and they're with it and they want to talk about all about being a Marine. So the birthday ball, Washtenaw County, how do you find out about it? Well, you're going to want to go to, I guess you just go to birthday ball, Washtenaw County. There you go. And Google that, birthday ball, Washtenaw County. So happy birthday. Okay. Korea, the forgotten men. The forgotten war, they call it, in the face of you good men. We pretend it never happened and never speak of it again. We forget that the 54,000 killed, the 100,000 wounded or maimed. We'll cut it out of our history books and never speak of it again. But there are nearly 8,000 missing, and the families remember their names. And nearly a million that served there, that came home, and were never the same. To pretend it never happened and never speak of it again. Finally, some 60 years later, we stand and salute you men. We'll raise a flag and drink a toast to wars forgotten, and then we'll welcome you home and shake your hands. And it's okay for hugs and tears. And we'll hang our heads in humble shame because it took some 60 years. It's time that we said thank you for what you did back then. To say welcome home and God bless you. And to speak again and again of the honorable men who fought that war, never to be forgotten again. Welcome home.
Living at American House is like being on a cruise ship with all the lovely surroundings, the many, many activities, and the people to share with. It's so comfortable to be here. I feel safe. I don't have to shop. I don't have to cook. I don't have to clean up.
When you move into an American House senior living community, you open the door to a new world of possibilities. Our life enrichment directors are committed to enhancing the lives of residents every day. We look forward to finding out what interests you.
I just get dressed up and walk down to the dining room and enjoy my meals in the company of other people at my table.
For more moments made in American House, go to AmericanHouse.com. Again, that's AmericanHouse.com. Or watch us at YouTube.com/AmericanHouseLiving.
Living here has enriched my life. I'm Carol Huck, and I'm made in American House.
Every time you hear that, you want to salute the flag and get up and march and feel all the pride that the Marines do. And what better way to honor them than to have them on this program. And we're going to be talking about, of course, the Korean War, the forgotten war. Why was it forgotten? Probably because we were celebrating World War II. It was over. Oh, we were standing down. We had small force of what we did in Europe just 5 years before. Fought a great war. We're now in college on the GI Bill. And, well, we just didn't have time for the Cold War or anything like that. On the line with me today, my guest and featured guest today is retired Lieutenant Colonel William Latham. He's a writer, historian, course director of the United States Logistics University at Fort Lee, Virginia. He flew Chinook helicopters in combat during Operation Desert Storm. He wrote a book, Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea, and it was published earlier this year. You might want to pick that up, folks, that Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea. He and his wife reside in Petersburg, Virginia. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Colonel.
Thank you, Bob.
Good May I call you Bill?
I'm doing well, Bob. How are you?
Oh, good. But can I call you Bill?
That'd be great.
Great. Bill, where did Korea? Who heard Korea? Where did Korea come from? Was it part of China? Was it part of Japan? How did Korea get formed? What about all that, Bill?
Well, Korea is a peninsula off the connected to northeastern Asia, and it has lived and survived in the shadow of powerful expansionist Chinese emperors to the north for thousands of years and powerful expansionist Japanese emperors to the east for thousands of years. So your description on the website that Korea is a bit like the Belgium of Asia is a pretty good choice of words.
It's stuck. And it's
it is stuck.
Stuck there, and it's like little Jack Horner stuck his thumb in the pie and pulled out a plum. Boy, you could stick your hand in there and get in a lot of trouble in North Korea. It's been and you had Chiang Kai-shek after World War II. I don't think we really liked him, but he was anti-communist. Anything anti-communist after World War II was a big, I mean, give them money, give them whatever, no matter how despotic they were. And that was, well, what should tell us about Chiang Kai-shek?
Well, Chiang Kai-shek was essentially a warlord who rose to power and ruled part of China under the Chinese nationalist government. And he was involved in a bitter civil war with Chinese communists led by Mao Zedong, and that civil war was being fought during the 1930s at the same time that the Japanese Empire decided to expand into China. And so the communists and the nationalists declared something of a truce to resist the Japanese invaders with limited success. Both the nationalists and the communists were able to defend portions of the country and keep the Japanese out of there, and the nationalists managed to do that with billions of dollars of U.S. aid helping them. And we did hope that the Chinese nationalists would gain control of the entire country after the war, but once World War II ended, the Civil War resumed. U.S. efforts to broker a ceasefire and some sort of ceasefire that truce that with both sides learning to live together did not work. In fact, General George C. Marshall,
the Marshall Plan. Yep,
that's right. He was the state Secretary of State for Harry Truman, and he famously went to China and visited with Mao Zedong, and came back and let Truman know that there was not much hope in the situation, that the communists were not willing to meet our demands, and the nationalists did not really have much of an army to resist. Well, they had a lot of men in their army, but they were not well led, they were not well trained, and the nationalist government under Chiang Kai-shek was inherently corrupt.
Well, apparently,
so there were no friends. We had no friends in that fight.
Well, but why that little country would China even care about that? Can you maybe touch on that? What would be the purpose of annexing Korea for China? What was going on?
Well, mainly China. Mao Zedong, after seizing power in the fall of 1949 and driving Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists off the Chinese mainland to Taiwan, after he seized power, he did not want to see a pro-U.S. Korean peninsula on his doorstep. So Communist China viewed the North Korean regime north of the 38th parallel is a very important and useful buffer zone. And so that buffer zone was, of course, at great risk when MacArthur led UN forces north of the 38th parallel in the fall of 1950. And although the Chinese warned Truman and MacArthur and the UN leadership that they would respond with force if UN forces went north of the parallel, our leaders ignored those warnings. They thought they were a bluff. And moreover, MacArthur promised Truman that any Chinese incursion would result in a terrible slaughter of the Chinese. As we know, things did not turn out that way at all.
Well, we'll get to that, too, because that is so important, and that's what kept things going for 3 years. But, okay, so we're now in this, and colonial powers were being defeated throughout the world, in Vietnam and the Hucks in the Philippines,
yeah.
And now we're driving out. We're driving out, it looks to me like anything to do with Western influence. So here it is. Here it is. We've stand down. We've got barely enough, not even a token force in Korea. I don't, as you said, we just didn't take it serious. And then on June the 25th, at around 5 o'clock in the morning, what happened? 1950.
Well, all hell broke loose. To put it mildly, the North Koreans attacked with 7 divisions, following a plan written by their Soviet advisors, and rolled across the border and steamrolled the South Korean army, a significant portion of which was not on duty that day. A portion of the South Korean army was fighting communist guerrillas in the south, and other portions were on weekend leave for the not for the harvest, but for the, anyway, they were, the South Korean lines along the DMZ were not well manned, and the North Korean army went through that defensive perimeter rather quickly and easily thanks to all of the tanks that they had been provided by the Soviets.
By the Russians.
They captured the South Korean capital, Seoul, within 4 days and thought that might achieve a quick coup d'etat, so to speak, but
it didn't
to their displeasure, the regime of Syngman Rhee did not surrender when the capital fell. Rather, he and his government fled south at the same time that Harry Truman decided to commit U.S. forces and later U.N. forces to defend the Korean Peninsula against what was obviously a North Korean invasion.
So, it was an invasion. Now we've got this tinderbox. It's like stepping on the trip plunger of a landmine, and you can't take your foot off because if you do, the whole thing's going to blow up. And here they are, the Americans. It was then given to the State Department on June 25th. And who was the Secretary of Defense then? Was that?
Secretary of Defense was Lewis Johnson. The Secretary of State was Dean Acheson.
Dean Acheson, okay. And our president, of course, was Harry Truman.
President was Harry Truman. Acheson had famously given a speech in Washington in January of 1950, announcing or defining the American sphere of influence in the Pacific, and he drew a line, and the Korean Peninsula was clearly outside the line of defense that he defined, which included Japan and the Philippine Islands, for example. And critics have in the past pointed to that speech as an unforgivable sin that sent the wrong message and invited communist aggression. But that's a bit of a myth. In fact, U.S. policy had dismissed the idea of defending Korea against a communist invasion for well over a year. MacArthur was aware of that. The chiefs of staff were aware of it. Acheson and the Secretary of Defense were aware of it. But when the North Koreans did actually invade, assuming that the U.S. would not respond, Truman felt obliged to do something.
And he didn't.
I think the fact that we had not been able to do anything about the communist seizure of power in China certainly influenced that decision by Truman.
And Truman did not go to the UN first when he started sending troops. Is that correct?
Well, he initially ordered MacArthur to send military aid and to provide air cover for the evacuation of U.S. citizens. But his Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, did move very quickly to line up U.N. support, and that included a resolution passed by the U.N. in the Security Council to commit forces to defend South Korea. And they were able to get that resolution only because the Soviet Union was at the time boycotting the Security Council.
Okay, so it's June 25, shots ring out, here it is, it's starting, and what were the Americans, what in the world were they thinking about what's going on here? Is this an exercise? Is this a training? What is this? And how soon and close could they get rescuers to come from? I think they came from Hawaii. So why don't you cover those two parts?
I'll be glad to. We had about 450 advisors on the ground in Korea with the South Korean Army. And most of those advisors were pretty quick to realize that this was a major North Korean invasion. Unfortunately, the South Korean troops were poorly equipped and not very well trained. They were tough as nails, but they weren't very well equipped. They weren't very well trained. And they did not fare well during the first week of fighting. And that was the main reason that the South Korean capital fell so quickly in 4 days. But Truman, MacArthur, with Truman's permission, began sending aircraft to attack North Korean columns that very first week of the war, and that helped a little bit. And then the Truman administration agreed, after MacArthur famously visited the battlefield that first week, he came back and notified the Joint Chiefs, and he notified the White House that the only way to stop the North Koreans would be through the use of American ground forces. And at that point, Truman gave MacArthur permission to send ground forces from Japan. We had four divisions on the ground in Japan as part of the post-war occupation force. They had been on occupation duty for most of that time and had just started training for combat missions within the year prior to the beginning of the Korean War. They too were poorly equipped. Most units were at two-thirds strength, two-thirds of their troops, two-thirds of their equipment, two-thirds of their supporting artillery, almost no tanks, and very few combat aircraft.
And we were pretty much throwing spitballs at those T-34s. With the lack of real equipment, again, it was a stand-down time with this country. Tell us a little bit about, we've only got about 3 minutes before the break, halfway, so tell us a little bit about the equipment as far as weaponry that we had at that time, including something to challenge the M-15s. And we'll get...
Well...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we... The American Armed Forces that fought in Korea initially fought with World War II equipment, much of it out of date, much of it in poor condition. And the American forces in Japan were so poorly equipped, partly because the American public was in a rush to dismantle the enormous military structure that we had created while winning World War II. There was also some thinking that nuclear weapons and our monopoly on nuclear weapons, which we had until 1949, would serve as a cheap deterrent to Soviet aggression. And then Mr. Truman's Secretary of Defense, Lewis Johnson, was a notorious cost cutter and did not make matters better. And moreover, the Truman administration was under pressure from Republicans in Congress to reduce defense spending. So all of these things combined together to create what we refer to as a hollow force. We had a lot of men in uniform, but they were not very well equipped, and they really were not well organized to fight a large-scale conventional war like the one that broke out in Korea.
And we're being pushed back, pushed back as more troops were getting pushed south, south, south. The South Korean Army, the American Marines are being pushed all the way into Pusan. We've got about 2 minutes. Tell us about the Pusan perimeter.
Well, the Pusan perimeter was formed after 4 weeks of fighting. American and Korean forces dug in along the river formations north and to the west of the port city of Pusan. And that area is a relatively small area in the southeast corner of South Korea. And it was in these mountains and hills where American and South Korean forces made their last stand and dug in.
And that was it. That was it. We were not going to retreat. We were not going to pull out, correct?
That is correct. And we started to, we stopped giving up ground around the first week, last week of July, the first week of August. And the North Korean invaders made a terrible mistake. They sent a column off to the right, to the south, to outflank American and Korean forces defending along Highway 1, which bisects the Korean Peninsula from Seoul down to Busan. And it was along that highway that most of the big battles were fought during the month of July. The North Koreans had wisely sent a flanking unit around the American left flank, which was completely undefended, but that division dawdled and got down to the southern tip of Korea too slowly, giving the Americans time to react.
Okay, we're
coming. Stop them a few miles from Pusan.
Bill, we're coming up on a break. You're listening to Veterans Radio here on Wham Radio. We'll be right back.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Okay, all the Marines heard that one. That's, I believe, that was Semper Fidelis? No, that couldn't be. Was our guide. But anyway, it came from the Marines album, CD. No, DVD. Whatever they are, we've got the Marine thing. And we're talking right now with Lieutenant Colonel retired William Latham of the West Point and Army Logistics Center. And, okay, it's now we've regrouped. Resupplied, restocked down in Pusan. We're down in the southeastern corner of South Korea, and we're going to be doing something. Something's up because they've got. Now, I'm not a big fan of MacArthur. I thought he was a big pompous baboon, but anyway, he had a brilliant plan. Tell us about that.
Well, Bob, MacArthur, from the very first week of the Korean War, envisioned an amphibious assault that would outflank the North Korean invaders and cut off their logistics from the rear. At first, he planned to use the 1st Cavalry Division in that operation, but quickly realized that the North Koreans were advancing too quickly and that he needed the 1st Cavalry to defend the Pusan perimeter. So then he persuaded the Marine Corps to endorse his idea. This also got the Marine Corps into the war. The Marine Corps Commander General Lem Shepard was the senior Marine that MacArthur approached about this idea. And MacArthur directed his staff, long before the Pentagon approved the idea, to begin planning for a major amphibious assault that would outflank the Koreans. They looked at several locations, and they decided on Incheon, which was perhaps the worst place in the world to conduct an amphibious assault, but it was also a place that was undefended or virtually undefended by the North Koreans. And so even though within a couple weeks prior to the assault, the Chinese and the Soviets both warned the North Koreans of the possibility of an American landing there, the North Koreans did not respond effectively. They did not put they didn't put mines in the water. They didn't mine the harbor, and therefore the American and South Korean invasion fleet landed in mid-September almost unopposed and were able to seize the port, and within a week, Marine and Army units were fighting their way into the city of Seoul. That completely changed the tenor of the Korean War.
Well, let's go back to that time, September 18th, 1950. Incheon, I've got with us two other guests. And on the line with me is, and both of these gentlemen are from the 1st Marine Division, the 1st Marine Regiment, Fred Socio and Paul Cole. They're with us, folks. Marines, Korean War veterans. Welcome, Fred. Welcome, Paul, to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, first, Fred.
Yes,
Chesty Puller, Marine. He was the guy in charge. He was the Marine commander, and you were his cook. Tell us about Chesty Puller.
He was just a great guy, and it was a pleasure to serve with him, and to this day I think of him all the time. He's a hero.
And
I just picked up the American Legion book that I got every month, and there's pictures in there talking about him.
And you were right there with this great commander, historical commander, the iconic commander of the Marine Corps, especially in Korea. Tell us about the LST incident and Chesty Puller.
Well, we took the LSTs from we jumped off from Kobe into Incheon, and we were on LSTs, and they were manned by Japanese, and we almost capsized on one of them, and everybody got up running around, wouldn't know what the hell was going on. And the only guy that was snoring away was Chesty.
He was not.
Didn't bother him a bit.
And he wasn't like sawing logs, so he was just taking looking at the inside of his eyelids, right? He probably, not much I can do around here right now, and think I'll just close my eyes for a moment. That was the kind of man he was. He wasn't running around with his chicken in chicken.
He never got emotional at all. When he got up, he had his pipe in his mouth, and he said, "On it, the fireworks going to start." And the destroyers come real close to shore, and I really laid it on there. And he was something else, I tell you.
And you made some soup for him.
Well, yeah, I had he wanted some soup, and we didn't have much to do, any cooking gear or anything. So I made some soup, and someone brought it up to him, and then about 10 minutes later, he came running back to our tent, and the flaps flew open, and everybody froze.
There he is.
And I think he thought we were going to poison him or something. So he says, "Who made that soup?" So Bobby Clark is pointing to me. "Fred Sozio did it, Sergeant Sozio." He come over to me, he's put his arms around me, and he says, "Souls, that's the best goddamn soup I had in a long time."
Wow, that's a quote, folks. That's why we're okay. We are on radio, remember. We are on radio.
But that's
a quote from Chesty Puller. So yep. He had his soup. You had your moment. Paul, where were you during the invasion of Incheon?
I was on the LST. The Fox got me Amtrak's on the 15th, and I was up in the weather deck with my Jeep. And we didn't go in until the next morning. Well, they run the LST up on the beach, and we come off the LST, and we started moving through Incheon right away on the way to Seoul.
And were you taking fire?
Not at any time. They pretty well took care of that before we landed. They landed on the 15th about 6 o'clock at night, and we went ashore in the morning. They had run that LST up on the beach to get our jeeps off the weather deck.
And an LST, folks, is, you've seen those. They've got a big, the front end opens up, and
yeah,
all the equipment comes out. What's a weather deck?
The weather deck is the top deck, exposed to the weather.
I guess
and
so.
All the jeeps and trucks were up on that deck. And down below, there was a tank deck with Amtraks. And on the 15th, when the invasion started, they opened up the bow ramps, and the Amtraks went right into the water. But we were up on the top deck with our vehicles, and we had to wait till next morning when they could run the LST up on the beach.
Well, you're at Incheon. And Paul, when was the first time you saw the enemy?
Well, they landed. It was about 6 o'clock at night. It was dark. And as soon as the Amtrak flipped the LST, some small craft started bringing wounded to shore, and they set up a hospital right on the old empty tank deck. And it was dark. I could hear the command over the water to land the landing force, and the Amtraks and landing craft went in there. We was up on the weather deck waiting for the next morning.
And
we just got ready.
Did you?
I had a jeep and trailer, and I had to drive it off that LST.
Did you ride home before you went ashore?
No.
You didn't write a last letter home?
Oh no. I'd been in the Marines for 3 years by that time. We were pretty well used to it. We made a lot of landings practice wise in peacetime. We were pretty well used to it.
And you got ashore, but you didn't have any billets. You didn't? Did you start moving immediately, or did you set up camp?
Yeah, it was amazing. I saw some, they were unloading 5-gallon cans of gasoline on the beach. And on one side, I went to the other side and started loading them on my Jeep trailer. I loaded up a trailer load of gasoline. And then we found guys from our company, and we took it off from there. We started going on the road to Seoul right away.
And was the road open?
Oh, yeah. The troops had been up ahead of us.
Okay.
We were the first Marines, and the other Marines had been up that road already fighting. They fought all the way to Seoul.
Fred.
We just followed along. We dug in at night, and in the morning they jump off. I was a driver for the regimental operations officer, Major Lorigan. And his leg man, the guy that did all the work, was Lieutenant Worcester. I always had him at my Jeep.
Tell me about digging in real quick. What is digging in?
It means you dig in for the night, you stop moving, you dig a hole, and you get in there and set up a defense line.
You didn't have
so they can't attack
you didn't
at
have
night.
Any.
And in the morning, they'll have a frag order come out, tell them the land companies when to jump off into the assault. And they take off, and everybody starts moving. We move continually, except at night.
And
then we dig in for defense purposes.
Fred, how did you get ashore after Incheon?
How did I get ashore?
I drove my Jeep off the weather deck. The LST went up on the beach, and I drove it off the ramp right onto the beach from the LST.
Fred, how did you get ashore?
On foot.
Okay.
Paul was lucky he didn't get wet. We did.
And so, did you have a change of clothes?
No.
Oh, how do you get dry?
Well, you keep walking around and they dried out.
So there you are. Did you have enough ammunition? Both. Paul, did you?
Oh, we had ammunition. We had no problem there.
You had enough ammunition. So
oh,
you.
Yeah.
But.
Everybody was packing.
and okay, let me get back to Bill. Bill, they crossed the 38th parallel. They're moving north and. MacArthur was even thinking of using nuclear warheads, and he was feeling his Cheerios. He must have been, his chest was pumped out. He just had this successful landing. They're moving north. They're heading. It's getting into October, November. Here we are, Thanksgiving. Take us back to them.
Well, MacArthur was so confident that at the Wake Island conference with President Truman, he discussed the possibility of transferring one or more Army divisions from Korea to Germany by Christmas. And he assured Truman that any Chinese incursion would result in MacArthur's term, the greatest slaughter. Unfortunately, that's not how it worked out. MacArthur did one smart thing and one stupid thing during that month. The smart thing he did was wait for a UN mandate before he sent UN forces north of the 38th. And that was important because MacArthur was aware that he had a negative image among the Allies and that they saw him as a rogue commander. So it was a smart move on his part to wait until he got that mandate. But the foolish thing he did was he really tried to repeat his success at Incheon a second time, and he reloaded the 1st Marine Division back onto landing craft and, along with the 2nd Infantry Division, and they sailed all the way around the Korean Peninsula to the east side of North Korea to conduct amphibious landings at the port of Hamnung and Wonsan. Unfortunately for MacArthur, the North Koreans this time had mined the harbors, and the Marines, and your other two guests probably remember this, had to sail around in circles for a week waiting for ships to clear the Marine, mines from the harbor.
Paul,
meanwhile, both the 8th Army under General Walker and Korean forces on the East Coast were progressing almost unopposed towards the Yalu River. And as early November turned to mid-November, it really looked like the war was all but over.
Well,
in fact, Time magazine published a cover story on how we won the war, and that story was published in the first week of November. Of course, we hadn't won the war. We thought we would rush to the Yalu, mop up the North Koreans, and hand over a reunified Korea to the South Korean government for a transition to a democratic country. That's what we thought. The Chinese had other ideas. They snuck several hundred thousand men into North Korea under cover of darkness and hiding in the mountains, unobserved by American aircraft. And in late November, the Chinese sprang a massive counterattack, which drove back the 8th Army on the west side of Korea and encircled the 1st Marine Division at the Chosin Reservoir.
Well, I got a little ahead of the story because Paul, you were involved in that second invasion, is that right? Paul? Paul, are you still there? Oh, Fred, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. Wow, we must have lost Paul. Maybe you can pick him up, Nina, because he was at that second invasion.
I was too.
Oh, tell us about that.
Yeah, but the colonels got it right. We couldn't get in there for a while until the Navy cleared all the mines, and the mines they had, that was on the beach was just, you wouldn't believe the amount of mines was there. We couldn't believe it, and we went there, and that's where we headed up north from Wonsan.
How much resistance was there at that point?
Oh, we had some resistance all the way up.
So when
What happened if they didn't listen to O.P. Smith? The colonel will verify that he didn't want us to go up there at all. He had great intelligence that the Chinese were up there.
Now we're talking the Chosin, right in that area.
Right. He didn't want to go up there at all.
Tell us about that, Bill.
The reservoir was not really a strategic asset. When the Marines got to the plateau on which the Chosin Reservoir sits, about 70 miles north of Wonsan, the temperatures dropped about 40 degrees in a single day, and the 1st Regiment there, I believe, was the 7th Regiment under Litzenberg, encountered over 200 cold weather injuries on the first day that the temperatures plunged. Fortunately, the Marines were better equipped for the cold weather than the Chinese, many of whom were wearing tennis shoes, and in fact, in the later battles, cold weather injuries put more Chinese out of action than Marine gunfire, although that was pretty formidable. But MacArthur had a really And his subordinate, Ned Almond, had completely underestimated Chinese resistance, and they planned to push all of their forces north on separate lines of advance that could not support each other north to the Yalu. And there really was just this headlong rush to the Yalu initially. There's a mountain range in between the Chosin Reservoir and the forces on the east coast, and then General Walker's 8th Army on the west coast. And when the Chinese ambushed Walker's 8th Army on the west coast, MacArthur changed the orders for the Marines and directed them to push due west into the mountains. It was an insane idea. And fortunately, the Marines did not get too far into those mountains before the Chinese attacked. If the Chinese had attacked, if the Chinese had let the Marines go another couple of miles to the west down those mountain trails, this is the 5th and 7th Regiment at Chosin, they could have easily cut off the 5th and 7th Regiments from the main base at the Chosin Reservoir, and it would have been might have been a different story. But fortunately, the Chinese did not let the Marines advance too far to the west, and the entire perimeter at the Chosin Reservoir came under Chinese attack. And after defeating those attacks, General Smith and the 1st Marine Division and what was left of the Army's 31st Regiment were able to fight their way back down the trail they'd come up, while the 1st Regiment under Colonel Puller held a defensive perimeter at Kodo Ree, and that was really a critical defensive spot because that was the back door for the rest of the Marines to get back down out of the mountains.
Now, guys, Fred,
yes.
Paul, that we got Fred. Fred, you were a part of that. You were in the 1st Regiment. Tell us about right at that moment. Here we are in November. It was right around Thanksgiving. And you started to hear what? Bugles? Whistles? What did you hear?
Yeah, bugles. And, yeah, they used to come at nighttime with bugles and horns and all that junk.
And
the colonel's right. The 5th and the 7th retreated back to Kodo Ree where we were. And we were the last one. The 1st Regiment on the Chesty, we were the last ones to pull out of the reservoir. And we took, you know, all our equipment, all our wounded, and all our dead, as much as we could take out, we took.
And were you? I mean, I know I have to ask this. Were you scared later, or were you scared then?
Everybody was scared. If they weren't, they weren't normal.
Because you were getting, you were being chased essentially.
Well, we had two enemies. We had the cold weather plus the Chinese.
How did you stay warm?
Pardon?
How did you stay warm?
Well, we had some good parkas, heavy parkas that were very good, and we had shoe packs, but when you walked around during the day, your feet would sweat, and at nighttime, they'd freeze up a little bit, and so I still have trouble with my feet, and if my feet are always cold, and I still take a hot water bottle to bed with me every night to keep them warm.
Because of the injury you received at the Chosin.
40 below zero, you know, and you're living outside.
What did you eat on the you weren't retreating, you were withdrawing, okay? So we'll say that. But
we were attacked in a different direction, as O.P. Smith said.
We're attacking in a...
That's the story anyway.
Colonel...
Smith was credited with saying that, but that was actually not Smith's style. Some reporter asked Smith a question about that at the reservoir, and Smith gave an answer, and the reporter said something like, "Do you mean you're attacking in another direction?" And Smith said, "Yes, that's what I meant." So basically, some reporter put those words in Smith's mouth, but it's a great line, and it really is, it does accurately capture what happened. The Marines did fight their way out of the Chosin Reservoir down a long, narrow mountain road, and the entire 1st Marine Division was strung out in a long column. The infantry had to dismount and conduct fighting patrols on the ridge lines to deter and defeat Chinese snipers and Chinese ambushes. And it was a long, hard fight getting down off of that mountain.
Yeah, there was 13 miles down.
How many miles, Fred?
13 miles in one way. It wasn't two-way highway. Just one way.
Could you travel on the road, or did you have to travel off the side of the road?
No, there was no side of the road. You couldn't pull over to let another vehicle go by you because, you know, you'd go over. That's how narrow it was.
And how did you? I mean, I'm sure you got fuel to these, to this convoy, this march, this thing is. How did you get fuel to them? Was it already there, or what was the situation?
Well, we had tanks, you know, have the fuel, and our tanks had all their gasoline on their turrets, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they had it there. And there's a lot of things I forget, Bob. You know, it's been a while.
Oh, but you're doing great. How about it, Colonel? Is he doing great?
He's doing great. Bob, one of the other things General Smith did that was very smart was that he insisted on building an airfield at the Chosin Reservoir.
That's
and because
right.
he built that airfield, the Marines were able to fly out hundreds of casualties, which
yep.
made it a lot easier for them to fight their way down that mountain road. And they were able to fly in supplies and reinforcements.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fred.
Yes.
So, you know, that's the first I've ever heard of this airfield thing.
Well, they laughed at him, actually. They thought he was kind of nutty to build an Air Force.
And,
an airfield.
But it, and so did it actually, did you guys notice that you were able to move a little quicker now that you didn't have the wounded and...
Oh, yeah, we took our wounded out of there.
I know, but...
We were the first ones to put our wounded on the helicopters on the side, and then they did it in Vietnam, but we were the first ones to have a wounded fly on the side of a helicopter.
Oh, okay, yeah, like you see in MASH.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so there you are, and folks, we're going to come back to this in another program. We are really going to come back to this and start right at the part of the Chosin, and because I know that's a heck of a story.
I got to tell you another story before you hang up.
Please do.
General MacArthur was coming up and to visit Chesty, and Chesty says, "Well, you tell him to come up to see me."
And did he?
He did, because I was about 10 feet from MacArthur, and he trudged up the hill, and he gave Chesty a Navy Cross, and he put it back in his back pocket.
Chesty did. And here was MacArthur, right?
Yeah.
What did he have his pipe?
Nope. He had a convoy of about 15, 20 jeeps behind him, and... two or three in front of him. He was well protected.
Okay, yeah. Well, we've got a minute. So I'm going to say, until next time, both you guys, I want you to come back. We're going to talk more about this whole Korean War thing. Probably won't be until December or January when we have another open date. But thank you very much, Bill Latham. I didn't get a chance to talk about your latest thing at Kuwait. When you're, let's get that music up. Yeah, when you're doing logistics training, I wanted to talk about that. We'll get to that at another point. And remember, folks, to go out, you want to have something of Cold Days in Hell, American POWs in Korea, Cold Days in Hell, and it's available from Texas A&M University Press and both Barnes
& Noble. Is the Colonel there?
Yes, go ahead. Real quick. Semper Fi.
Semper Fi to you. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, take care, Fred. Now,
all right, good night.
Bill,
thanks,
Bill,
Fred.
Will you come back and finish the story or keep going with the story? Will you come back?
Of course, Bob.
I'm knowing
you. Thanks very much for having me as a guest.
And thank you again. He's a many, many time guest on our program. Whew. How much time we got, Nina? 10 seconds. Good. 9 seconds. Here we go. Okay, next week it's going to be Jim Falzone. So until then, all of you, you are dismissed.